Welcome to this episode of Another World is Potable. My name is Peter Bloom, and get ready to emancipate your mind and radically expand your imagination as we present all the most exciting and revolutionary possibilities of our times, both locally and globally. I hope you enjoy it, and as always, solidarity today, tomorrow, and forever.
Welcome to a new episode of Another World is Potable. I think this is a really interesting and very timely episode, I believe. We're going to be talking to two kind of theorists and activists who are really getting to the core of how this current crisis is asking us and demanding from us to really rethink what is essential work, and more to the point, why do we value what we value and what should be considered valuable? So I'm joined by one of my absolute favorite intellectuals, Sarah Fetters, and also a former student of mine and someone whose work I've looked from afar and really, really feel excited about, Mark Bergfeld. So thank you both for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having us, Peter.
Thank you, Peter, yes.
So I'll kind of get right to it because I think there's a lot to discuss, and what you wrote about was in many ways for me, one of the most, if not the most important intervention around what's currently happening. So you wrote this fantastic article in this new journal Spectre that I would say everyone should check out. It's a wonderful new journal. And you make the point about essentially our ideas of skills-based employment are very narrow and actually reproduce very particular sets of power relations. And instead you argue for what you call life-making labor. So I thought maybe you could just give us a sense of what is a life-making labor and how does it differ from traditional capitalist ideas of skills-based employment?
Yes. We use the word life-making labor, life-making work, in the way used especially by Marxist feminist historian Titi Bhattacharya, who is the author of an important collection on social reproduction theory. And she has begun, to give credit to her work, really, she's begun using this term to describe those activities that enable the reproduction of life and society, and that usually we also call social reproductive activities. And so we are talking about caring for elderly people, caring for children, cooking meals, cleaning, all those activities that enable, in fact, the reproduction of life, and that are very feminized, very gendered, because these are activities that have been historically undertaken and performed especially by women, very often for free. Women still do it for free, but I think they're also the one important, change that we need to register is that increasingly these jobs are done also in a commodified form. Increasingly, women are paid for this work, and it's especially migrant women who tend to be migrant and racialized women who tend to be very present in these life-making activities. Just think, for example, of the nurses that now are classified as key or essential workers. Many of those nurses, I'm thinking of the UK, which is where I live, but also in other countries are very often migrant workers. So these are the life-making works and laborers that we talk about. And when you ask how they differ from traditional ideas of skills-based employment, well, I think the first thing to say is that, under capitalism, many of these were not even considered works or skills. They were really considered as kind of vocational activities that women do as if there is something natural, really a vocation in them that just tells them, you should know really how to clean, how to take care of children, etc. So they have not been considered skills, and that's also one of the reasons why these life-making jobs are also so badly paid and so badly considered and stigmatized in our societies.
Yeah, I think where I think Sarah makes a really valid point there. The basic premise is that both care work and agricultural work, which we point to in the article, have been excluded from like traditional work regimes per se. If you look to the United States, for example, the Labor Relations Act, the NLRB and NLRA, excluded domestic work predominantly conducted by African-American women, as well as agricultural work, which is conducted by Mexican or Latino and Latina labor. In particular, if you look to Europe, you see that a lot of domestic work is first in the early 2000s actually was put into labor law. And so our starting point really is that these jobs make our world go round. They are the basis, and they're the basis of our societies. And often our economies don't account for that work in the traditional ways that they measure growth, productivity, and all the various capitalist paradigms. So in my day job, I ended up going, and this is my approach to our article, really, I ended up going to an OECD presentation and heard that because there weren't any productivity gains to be made from these kinds of jobs, we wouldn't be able to expect any kind of wage increases in the future. And so for us, now deeming these jobs essential jobs actually poses the question, like, well, is it possible actually now to not only fight for wage increases in these occupations, but actually also give a completely different value to these jobs, which puts the kind of traditional hierarchy on its head.
And I do think that, you know, before getting specifically to the COVID-19 crisis, one of the aspects that I've been very interested in terms of this is the ways in which you do see this being commodified in the corporate world increasingly in terms of self-help. So it's very interesting to me that as neoliberalism has intensified, this kind of life-making activities, you know, whether it be kind of self-care, whether it be mental health, in order to deal with work intensification, has become, you know, a huge kind of multi-billion dollar industry, and who that's privileging in a certain aspect sense as well. So I think, you know, this idea of life-making labor and how this actually then refocuses attention from economic growth towards actually what is the labor that goes into, you know, reproducing our society, reproducing our existence, and who's doing this and how's it being rewarded is so important. What I found really fantastic though, well, not fantastic in a kind of critical sense, but, you know, so insightful was in your article, you've kind of said though that the current COVID-19 crisis has really turned the labor market on its head and made this type of labor something that has become seen as so much more important. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, about how you think this crisis is in many ways bringing this, you know, ongoing contradiction within capitalism really to the forefront.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So our basic starting point is that the current COVID-19 crisis is causing a lot of pain and suffering for working people. They're losing their loved ones. A lot of people are being made redundant. A lot of people are being put on short-time work, and a lot of the estimates from the ILO, for example, or other large-scale international institutions are saying that some of these jobs will never return. So we do need to bear that in mind. Within that, there is a kind of underlying current which has gone over to actually categorizing or deeming like particular blue-collar jobs and what we call life-making work, calling them as essential work or categorizing them as key work. And it is very reminiscent of World War II, the kind of war economy, the kind of sense that these are the jobs that need to be performed. And of course, it's great that we have seen millions of people from Italy to Britain to Belgium to and the rest of the world come out and clap for care workers or clap for NHS workers or clap for these types of essential workers. However, we draw out that the category of the essential worker is actually a double-edged sword, right? On the one hand, there's new value given to the so-called low-skilled laborers and low-skilled workers. On the other hand, it's also the case that these essential workers have to work in hazardous, in unbearable working conditions. And we're seeing new forms of struggle emerge around around deeming these workers essential workers. So a couple of days ago, Germany had imported a bunch of Romanian agriculture workers to pick asparagus. And these workers were living in barracks, which don't even reach ILO standards. And the workers now are striking not only for higher wages, but also against the kind of living conditions that they're living in. So a real strike that emblematizes social reproduction. The second thing that we're seeing is that a lot of the essential workers are actually not going to be privy to pay rises. So if you look to Britain, you see that the Tories say there should be a pay freeze for the public sector in the next 2 years. So essential worker can also be a tool by the ruling class and by employers to force workers to work under conditions which are unbearable as such.
And did you want to add to that as well, Sarah? Because I think that was such a good explanation, but there's so much more to discuss too.
Oh, well, I think Mark really said really, really well, and it was very, very exhaustive. Maybe the only thing I would add is that one of the other traps that we analyze in our article about this new dichotomy, essential, non-essential workers, is also that the essential, the people who define the essentiality, we can say, of this work are still the capitalist and the ruling class in charge. And one of the risks is also that some jobs or sectors, such as the creative industries, for instance, which have been historically considered really non-essential from a capitalist viewpoint and are suffering enormously at the moment because of the lockdown measures, etc. I mean, the risk that we need to avoid is somehow to fall into the trap that those are precisely non-essential and therefore they don't deserve, for instance, bailout measures or other supportive measures for jobs and so forth. So in a way, we think, there are lots of contradictions, potentially interesting contradictions, but still capitalist contradictions going on. It's important, the acknowledgement that this work is important, it's vital, in fact, but at the same time, we need to bear in mind and remember who is defining, still in charge of defining this work. And what this means also for the definition of other work as non-essential.
Mm-hmm. And I think the example you gave, Mark, about going into the OECD kind of meeting and just seeing the ways in which there's such a disjuncture between the actually on the ground important work that people are doing to, again, reproduce our existence, reproduce our very life, and how it's viewed as something productive or non-productive and should be rewarded. And this speaks to, I think, more general issues that you bring up in your article, which is this relationship between skilling and reskilling and how actually this is not something neutral, but serves to, in fact, reinforce and reproduce capitalist power relations. And I think for a lot of people listening, even people, to the left, would kind of think, okay, well, you know, it's very important that, you know, we provide skills-based training for people. This concept of, you know, helping people acquire new skills can oftentimes be, you know, quite an empowering ideal, supposedly. But I think you do a fantastic job, both of you, in being able to show actually that this is not something that is neutral, so to speak, but is very ideological and very political. So if you could kind of talk a little bit about why you think we need to problematize this idea of skilling and reskilling.
Yeah, thanks. This is a very, very important question. I think that it's important here, one thing that we do in the article as well is to historicize a little bit the concept of division of labor, which is where this idea of skills and especially the hierarchy between low skills and high skills come from. Fundamentally, I mean, capitalist societies are fundamentally driven by this binary, which is the division of labor between intellectual and manual labor. And this is really the foundation of also the skills hierarchy. And we can see that, I mean, historically speaking, we have seen that the majority of workers have been increasingly relegated to jobs that are considered as low skill and in various, not only life-making sectors, such as agriculture or care, but also in other sectors. Factory workers are probably the paradigmatic example, historically speaking. But I think what's also interesting for us to analyze is how, particularly since the onset of neoliberalism, since the late 1970s, we have seen more of a segmentation of skills. We still have this dichotomy between high skills and low skills, but there has been also increasingly a segmentation in the labor market in which different categories of workers are in a way segregated into different types of skilled jobs. And these categories are very racialized and very feminized. So what we see is precisely that the labor market increasingly under neoliberalism has worked as a kind of pyramid with at the bottom, I would say almost the majority of workers are considered to be low skilled. And even within the same sector, we see that at the very bottom, those who are paid very little, very exploited and working in very unsafe conditions are especially racialized, migrant workers, very often feminized workers, whereas usually the better jobs are still reserved even within the same sector for more privileged, we can say, depending on the context as well, non-racialized workers. So these, but when we look actually at the definitions of these skills, we can see what I said earlier about the non-recognition of some jobs as skilled at all. And here again, it is especially these life-making jobs and activities in agriculture and care that have been the ones mostly categorized as low-skilled. And this is precisely, this reflects a hierarchy which is based upon a privileging of skills, the high skills as those who are based in scientific and technological knowledge. And so those really that are in a way more useful to the accumulation of profit and who are more useful from a capitalist point of view to profit making.
Yeah, just to bounce off of that, what we really see is that there's two categories of jobs in some ways. One is kind of like high value added jobs, and then there's the low value added jobs. And what I mean by high value added jobs are really those jobs which and this is what, for example, the British ONS does. It's like, how long does it take you to actually perform the job? and to learn the skills that you need to perform perform the job. And then there's also like, what kind of machinery is being used? Is it like algorithms, or is it computers, or is it just a broom and or a brush to brush someone's hair or cut someone's hair? And based on that, they evaluate whether a job is considered low skill or whether a job is considered high skilled. And what we really need to question is the fact that somehow these jobs, which require people to learn algorithms or high frequency trading, are actually high skilled jobs, and because they don't require interpersonal skills, often they don't require relational skills. They don't actually require to be a human or to be a person per se. And if you look at it, what is happening at the moment is exactly the opposite of what economists predicted a couple of years ago, where they said those jobs which are easily like imitable or replaceable are those at the bottom of the skills ladder. What we're actually seeing at this moment in time is a lot of white collar jobs are being replaced by algorithms, by are being automated or by computers that exactly require those kinds of high skilled quote unquote skills. So our point really is to say, like, listen, the current moment has thrown up a whole lot of questions about how our labor markets function and how dysfunctional they are. We're living in societies, as Sarah pointed out, where the majority of people are currently are being de-skilled or are working in so-called low-skill to no-skill no-skill jobs. And those are the jobs that are growing, whilst those in the middle stratum are really disappearing quicker than we thought they would. And that this is recomposing the working class and making it really difficult for working people to survive.
And I think what becomes also very fascinating about this, because I think everything both of you just said is so, I mean, right on. I mean, and so significant. I mean, almost that we need to take a pause to reflect on just how significant it is, and that, you know, we oftentimes assume that the amount of time it takes to learn something, particularly if it's technical, is what should bring it value. However, like you've said, not only are those increasingly being able to be replaced, but they're not necessarily adding value. I mean, one thing that I thought about when I read your article is that, in a sense, if you think about some of the most exploitive conditions right now, in many ways, like in an Amazon warehouse, the people who coded and made the algorithms to surveil and gamify people's the workers' kind of regime, you know, that was really, really horrible and has been challenged, that has like no social value at all. Whereas the people actually doing the work obviously have such huge social value. And so there's an inverse relationship as well between the sometimes the amount of time and energy and technical skill it takes to do something and the actual social value it has within a capitalist system. And I think so. The kind of points you both are bringing out are again just really crucial to understanding these very fundamental contradictions of how capitalism understands value and how capitalism understands skills. And when you speak about things like algorithms, it's also important to realize that the most important aspect is, in many ways, not the algorithm itself, but the values that are inputted by people's behavior. Right. So a lot of what we're seeing is the fact that if you really want to have interesting transhuman, you know, mutual intelligent design, you actually need, you know, to recognize the skills that goes into actually the people whose data is being collected on this. So I really think that, you know, it's almost like I want to take a pause if I can, which I don't think you're supposed to do during a podcast, and say that's such what you're raising is such a fundamental point and something that I think underpins pretty much every issue that we have currently, and it touches on so many different things. So I think looking then away from how capitalism imagines skills, if you think about something like life-making labor and life-making labors, and we actually took seriously the need to value that, how do you think this idea can really contribute to broader movements to challenge and radically transform capitalism for a society and economy that is more emancipated and does actually really recognize social value over profit value?
Yeah, just very briefly on that question, I think it's an important question because too often over the last couple of weeks, we're talking about like higher wages, better terms and conditions, and the kind of bread and butter issue. But we actually need to talk about the politics of this kind of work and labor, as well as our broader goals of social emancipation and social and economic transformation. And so I think that these jobs have an inherent inherent difference compared to, let's say, like traditional manufacturing jobs or other jobs, insofar as they actually stand in a relationship to a client or to the broader public. So it is very easy to conceptualize how care workers actually can build the link to the broader population and the broader public and build movements on that basis. So the clap for carers or clap for the NHS is an absolute astonishing example, because it shows that care workers and nurses have mobilized massive support amongst all sections of the population for their cause, which is kind of unthinkable if you think of a car factory worker, for example, or someone working at a conveyor belt. So I think that opens up new possibilities for radical social movements, for organized labor. And the second point really is that those sections of the working class have been less integrated into the kind of social democratic trade union apparatus, which often has actually, you know, worked in tandem or worked in convergence with, you know, governments and industry. And because that isn't the case, actually, these forms of struggle take on a much more politicized form and are able to go beyond the kind of bread and butter issues of the present moment, which also has implications on, like, how do we value this type of work? It isn't simply the fact that if you have productivity increases in care, there should be a wage rise, as, you know, the 20th century trade unionism always proposed, but actually, like, how do we actually transform, use these jobs and use these workers and their labor to transform the system?
Yes, just to follow up on what Mark was saying, because I totally agree. One of the elements, I think the potential of these, the mobilizing potential of these categories of workers is also at this moment their capacity to really involve and engage the public at large in their cause for safer work conditions and better jobs, to the extent that at least here in the UK, really this is news from last night, Boris Johnson in the end was forced to scrap the surcharge for migrant nurses. There was the absolute scandal in this country that migrant nurses have to pay a fee of £400 that the Tories wanted to increase to £650. And Boris Johnson, in spite of thanking the two migrant nurses who basically saved his life, was resistant until yesterday to scrap this fee, which is absolutely inhuman. So I think this also tells us something at really at the human level about the type of people we are talking about. But let me leave it there because and I just wanted to say ahead. That this is important also because there has been, as Mark said, lots of support from the public with the various Club for the NHS, Club for Workers, but also let's remember lots of workers themselves, nurses, Amazon workers have engaged in strikes and protests in the last couple of months. So these things have been so far, the whole crisis has been also incredibly mobilizing for these workers. Now, I think the challenge ahead is to see whether these struggles will stay to some extent conservative as they have been. And when I say conservative, what I mean is that they have been mostly about providing these workers with personal protective equipment, which should have been a given, not something they should have asked for. So the thing would to see would be whether these struggles become more, in a way, proactive and struggles for higher wages. So if they are called essential workers, these workers, let's see if there is the step of asking actually for these essential work to be recognized with better working conditions and higher wages.
And one of the aspects I think is also really interesting, and again, I don't mean to put you in the spot there, is that, I'll give a kind of quick publicity. So Sarah wrote one of, I think, the best books of the last 5 years, if you want to understand contemporary politics, In the Name of Women's Rights, The Rise of Feminist Nationalism. And I don't want to go fully into what is an extremely comprehensive and critically sophisticated argument that you're making, but one of the things that I was really interested in the article, but that you also bring in the book, is how do we make sure that these types of struggles do not simply play into existing kind of racial and, I would say, gender-based dynamics of instrumentalizing these women who are already marginalized for, in many ways, political projects and economic projects of which say they're doing it for their empowerment, but in many ways are really for continuing their exploitation and marginalization.
You're asking me this question, Peter?
Yes, is that right?
Okay, no, that's really, really important. Yes, one of the things that we need to be very careful about is one, the kind of even mental habit at thinking that these jobs are, necessarily performed by racialized migrant and feminized populations. So there is a certain, kind of racial and gender segregation going on in these jobs. And this is something that obviously the pandemic, the crisis generated by the pandemic has highlighted. And we also need to see how this will be challenged in the future struggles. And I think also one interesting aspect of this will also be to see how these various battles, as they are really undertaken by these workers, will be in a way instrumentalized by various political forces. And here what I have in mind is a little bit what I was mentioning earlier. As I said, Johnson was forced, at least here, to scrap the fee, the surcharge for migrant nurses who are saving lives. He wasn't forced by, in a way, workers themselves and worker struggles, although nurses have, various political forces have protested against it. But in the end, he was forced within his own party. Moral questions were raised by some Tory MPs themselves about really showing compassion, as they put it, for these workers who are doing such important work at the moment. So this is a little bit also the risk that I see, that there is a certain struggles risk staying conservative in the sense of maintaining a certain habit that the fact that these jobs are segregated by race and gender, but also that certain struggles have not been won by workers themselves, but by the generosity of the ruling class, in this case, the Tories. So I think these are also, I think, challenges that we have ahead.
And I think, you know, also part of that, and then I have a particular question for Mark on this, is the fact that if you look at the actual kind of right-wing protests in the United States to go back to work that have been, you know, understandably publicized in quite salacious ways because, you know, they're carrying these huge semi-automatic weapons oftentimes, but they're supposedly, they say, doing it in the name of often the most marginalized forces, marginalized populations, right? They're saying, oh, this is all a conspiracy, or this is being overblown, and this means that, like, you know, poor workers are not able to go into work. And in a sense, you can see how this type of astroturfing is actually instrumentalizing these very segregated, very marginalized workers for a political project that is, you know, not just about their continued exploitation, but actually saying, you know, in the name of your rights, we want you to go back to work and put your life in danger. And I think that leads into Mark. I mean, you work and have worked for organizations that are very particularly involved in worker struggles. And I'm wondering, do you see how this crisis is starting to shift some of the struggles potentially from things that are just about traditional kind of 20th century unionism of higher wages to something that's like more about, we want to change the entire ways in which we value things in our society, and therefore not just how we're compensated, but the power relations that that provides?
I think to just start off with the kind of Boris Johnson example that that Sarah mentioned, I think we need to really go back to the divisions of labor which characterize our contemporary capitalist societies in order to understand what is really at stake and what is really being demanded by those asking, you know, to open up our economies. So in many ways, what, you know, these white supremacists and protesters, you know, who are asking Trump or asking their governors to open up the economies in the US are doing is to say, like, listen, African-American lives, Mexican, Latinx lives are dispensable and they can be collateral damage so that I get my hamburgers, I get my steak, and I get my Starbucks. And we saw a similar dynamic actually operate around Brexit, where one woman once famously in the BBC said, like, who's going to be serving my, you know, cappuccinos at Starbucks once all the Eastern European immigrants are out? And so I think that we're seeing that the ruling class is trying to grapple with their kind of nationalist, like, close all the borders and shut down immigration on the one hand, and the need for capitalism to continuously grow the labor pool of workers and the reserve army of labor to keep, you know, to try to keep wages low. What does that mean for the current struggle? It actually means that, like, whether unions, community organizations, or political parties cannot simply rely on or depend on organizing the so-called, like, white working class, quote unquote, or the kind of traditional bastions of social democracy, which is organized labor, like all like different mining towns in the Northwest in the UK, or be it, you know, the traditional, like, voting base in the Midwest in the United States. But actually, we need to think about, like, consciously organizing feminized workers as well as racialized workers, because these are actually the workers that can start transform our economies and bring about a radical democratic project for the working class. And I think that if you don't do that, you're effectively paying the price that these workers will act as a pull on wages, on living standards, on working conditions, etc. Too often, like, the unions and social democratics have simply been blind to these questions and have either resorted to kind of a xenophobia or kind of dog whistle racism. And too many times it's simply, like, migrant rights activists or community activists or, like, independent unions or activists or labor or organizers within traditional trade unions which are picking up the baton and fighting. But it needs to become a central part of the kind of progressive and leftist project.
Absolutely. I mean, I want to talk in a moment about how you think this can lead to not just kind of nationalist kind of movements, but actually things that are more internationalist. But it also reminds me of the ways in which how so much of this life-making labor, like if you think about it in terms of outside capitalist relations, so like what would this potentially look like in a more emancipated kind of socialist economy? Like you already see hints about this, about like how when it's free from these constraints, how much people enjoy this work. I mean, I think about gardening, for instance. I know that sounds like a very banal example. I apologize. But these are things that actually, when they're freed from this, people actually see the real value it has, not just in reproducing their lives, but reproducing a fulfilling existence, right? So I think that, you know, we're also looking at the ways in which, you know, we have to not just try to empower these workers, but actually see this labor as something so fundamental to what it means to lead a fulfilling existence in life. But I think that then moves me to ways in which, you know, we've talked about a little bit about what's happening in the UK, but this is, you know, as you mentioned with particularly migrant labor, I mean, this is something that is about global movements of labor and capital, right? So how do you think these ideas and this notion, like, first of all, skills-based discourses help to reinforce and serve as a colonizing force to continue to divide and diversely exploit kind of the quote-unquote global north and global south? And how do you think if we started thinking in terms of life-making labors and life-making labor, that can contribute to building a more internationalist movement?
So I'll just have to go back a few steps in order to address your question, Peter. I think it's a very important question. So if we look at the European Union as such, we have one of the basic rights is freedom of movement, which applies to every EU citizen. It doesn't apply to those outside of the European Union. The same holds true for skills. So there's skills recognition programs, which mean that if you train as a nurse in Spain, theoretically, if you have the language level of a B2 English, you will be able to work in the NHS system, you'll be able to work in Germany, etc., or in any other European Union country. That doesn't apply for healthcare workers who are trained outside of the European Union. But however, the European Union as such, or Britain, recruits thousands and thousands of nurses from Nigeria, from the Philippines, from a number of so-called labor exporting countries, and has set up dual pathways or partnerships with those countries, which are akin to free trade agreements, which allow those workers to smoothly enter the labor market in Britain or in Germany or any of the kind of Western European countries we live in. So what you see is that there's a real hierarchy between those kinds of sending countries which exist. So for example, like Nigeria is known for like exporting doctors, Philippines like exports nurses. However, you often have countries which are completely excluded from sending skilled workers to other countries. So that's one way in which the kind of hierarchy between nations continues to be maintained, but as well as it forces those countries like the Philippines or Nigeria to continuously produce a supply of worker rather than actually alleviating some of the skilled shortages or alleviating some of the healthcare shortages within their own country. So for example, Sierra Leone, one of the poorest countries on the planet, was until recently we're still exporting healthcare workers, despite there only being like one nurse in 10,000 inhabitants. So we see those same dynamics actually take place there.
No, absolutely, and I think that's a really, really good and important point. Sarah, did you want to also
speak to that? What Mark said already, Mark already mentioned some of the things I wanted to say. I think the care drain that he's referring to is very, very important, has been really one of the ways in which this international division of skills has also been organized between the global north and the global south, with the former benefiting obviously from the so-called low skills, but still essential skills of the global south. The other thing, the second part of the question is also, I think, very, very important to address. I think there are interesting and very important ways in which these life-making workers can contribute to building an international movement. And I think we can already see ways in which this is happening. And the example that really comes to my mind, which is also one of the things on which I work, is the example of domestic workers. Domestic workers, many of whom are migrant and racialized workers, really across the world, really. They, in the last 20 years, they have built an organization, which is the International Domestic Workers Federation, which really began as more organization of domestic migrant domestic workers in a few European countries, trying really to address the lack of rights and lack of regulations that they were subjected to. Now, in the last 10 years, really, they have built a significant organization, which has influenced, for instance, the international the ILO, the International Labour Organization, to the extent that now there is a specific ILO resolution that is called the Decent Jobs for Domestic Workers. So it's a resolution that binds the countries that sign this resolution to make sure that domestic work is recognized as work, is regulated, and is subjected to the same treatment as other employed labor. It's been, obviously a victory with all limits that you can imagine, but it's still been an important way in which especially these workers have organized. And very, very recently, I'm talking really about a couple of weeks ago, the same group of workers has put pressure upon the Italian government for domestic workers and care workers employed in private households to be included in the bailout measures of the government. As you maybe know, Italy is one of the countries that very heavily relies on migrant women to take care of elderly people at home. These workers, in spite of the incredible work they do for the Italian economy and families, they were not included in the first bailout measures that were meant to give benefits and to help self-employed workers, various categories of workers who were encountering economic difficulties. These workers, domestic workers and carers, were excluded by these bailout measures, and they put pressure upon the government to be included, and they did so successfully. So now they actually have been included. This obviously is a very important victory for this category of workers. And I think it gives a little bit the sense of the ways in which it is possible to build an international movement, how these workers can really organize internationally. Obviously, Mark knows very well how this works and how important it is, much better than me. But I think we can really see how this is already working out, and I think we will see much more of this in the near future.
I think Sarah's point around domestic workers linking up internationally is one of the most underreported stories and most underinvestigated stories of the, because what we're seeing is really a grassroots movement of domestic workers, some of the most marginalized women in our economies, actually making huge institutional gains, right, through their power of organizing, coming together in communities, often, you know, like meeting on lawns or meeting in churches or mosques or wherever they might be, and often having their visas bound to the families that they're working for, making huge strides forward. So I think we should definitely congratulate them, but also like investigate their struggles more in depth. And the second thing that I think is if we look at, you know, whether it's Amazon warehouse workers, or if we look at care workers, or if we look at agricultural workers, is like capitalism at this moment in time has brought forth these big monopolies, really, right? Like whether it's Amazon, or whether it's, you know, big agribusiness, or whether it's even in the care sector, like Sarah has written a very good article on the corporatization of care. We see also market consolidation in care. So these companies are linking up actually workers around the globe. Suddenly they're working all for the same companies. So it's going to be necessary to also fight and organize across borders if we want to take on these companies who are commodifying, you know, life-making labor and life-making work.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the things that I think is so key and critical about this is how I know that the signification of essential versus non-essential work is very contentious, but I do think actually what you're seeing in this type of organizing is the beginnings of really expanding and updating what is the quote-unquote kind of proletariat of the 21st century. And I think that you can see that, for instance, if all domestic workers around the globe went on a general strike, the economy would stop, right? Similarly, like if all kind of quote-unquote care workers more broadly went on a general strike, the global economy would, you know, come crashing to a halt. And so I think a lot of it is being able to recognize that these are not ancillary workers, right? That these are, in many ways, the 21st century proletariat, and they're going to be the drivers of history in many ways. So I think this type of thinking about building an internationalist movement and looking at the ways in which you're already seeing organizing around that and some of the institutional gains speaks to the ways in which they're really recognizing the labor power that they have. And I don't know how both of you feel, but I can't imagine a kind of radical revolutionary movement for change that doesn't put that front and center.
Spot on.
So one thing I wanted to ask, and I think it's a particularly important here, is I usually tend to end the podcast by asking, like, what would you imagine another world like? I kind of would like to take a moment and, you know, you can answer in any ways that you want, but to just think about what do you think a different type of world would look like in which this type of life-producing labor, right, this life-making labor is really the thing that is valued. So not capital or profit-making labor, but life-making labor value. Like what would a type of socialist or anarcho-socialist or society and economy look like where we put front and center the value of life-making?
Well, it would be very different from... it would be different, especially in the sense that it would be recognized, it will be valued very important. It won't be feminized. It won't be as if only, you know, women especially should be the experts at doing some of these things. I guess for me in that sense would be very different, and it would be enjoyable because I think one of the things I think also Mark said before about, and I think you also, Peter, said one of the things that is also particularly interesting about life-making job is that when it is not subjected to the diktat of capitalist profit-making and exploitation and the unsafe conditions, the low pay that characterizes it, etc., etc., life-making work is actually enjoyable. It is relational, it is emotional labor, as some scholars and activists call it. It is caring, it is the work of love in many ways. It gives lots of, you know, personal rewards and satisfaction. You mentioned gardening, and I agree with you. It's labor when you do it for not under exploitative conditions. It's actually work that people enjoy. It feels useful. It feels valuable. So yes, I guess it would be a world in which we actually enjoy what we do, and which we value. Even when we don't enjoy what we do, we value the important things that keep our societies going, that are so important for them.
Yeah, I think Sarah's spot on when she says, "Look, it's being our lifeblood, our love, our care work is continuously being commodified, and is being used to make profits." And if you think about it, it would actually be very easy with the technologies that we have to, you know, workers organize care work themselves and collectively under democratic principles. And it actually also would be more effective because our communities would actually be served. And I think that that's really crucial if we're thinking about the ways in which care work is currently being organized. If you're thinking about it, most people perform care work for free. They do it for their loved ones, whether they be older people, disabled people within their families, or children within their family. And they do it on a continuous basis without, you know, ever questioning, you know, why they're doing it. And I think reevaluating this type of work in our society will make society generally a better place. But I also think that we need to think about the ways in which we can actually, you know, like democratize care work per se. And we have a long way to go. So I think in some ways, you know, we're really talking about another world when we're talking about reevaluing care work, reevaluing agriculture work, which feeds us every day, right? So,
And I have to say that I think both of that's what you've just shared is so inspiring, and it does bring us back to potentially the most core issue we have, which is, you know, there is a labor that goes into making our lives, you know, just reproducing it biologically, but also reproducing it socially. And it's our responsibility to find ways, both individually and collectively, to create a world in which that type of life-making labor is not only not exploitive, but as fulfilling and enjoyable as possible. So Sarah and Mark, I want to thank you both so much. Everyone, please go and check out their article called The COVID-19 Crisis and the End of the Low-Skilled Worker in the new journal Spectre.
Thank you, Peter, for having us. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Another World is Potable. My name is Peter Bloom, and remember, until next time, another world is not only possible, but happening right now.